Government Finance Committee to order. Members, before you, you have the two bills in your packet that are similar in nature, and we're going to start off with Representative Rosenthal's bill. And welcome to the committee. If you can, we'll do that in just a little bit. If you can state your name for the record. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Rosenthal, and I represent District 49B.
And to your bill, I'm going to move your bill, which is House File 918, to be referred to the Committee on GovOps. Just make sure we get it through all the hoops.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 918 came out of a working group with small businesses, large businesses last year that represent TSIN, and I and a number of representatives put together. This particular bill puts in a private letter ruling, which is, say you're a corporation and you have dealings that are very, very complicated. What you would do is you'd send the Department of Revenue a letter outlining your problems or looking for guidance how to best treat this in the tax code. And they would send you back a letter, which is the private ruling, saying exactly what you have to do and maintaining that this is how you should approach this on tax issues. And it's a private ruling, so no other corporation or individual sees these rulings. It's done on the federal level. It's done in 48 states. And, you know, the Department of Revenue is very, very strongly against this, and I've been talking to them and willing to work with them as if this bill progresses. I think it makes sense. You know, we don't want to get our corporations or individuals in trouble if they don't need to be, and that's what this attempts to do.
Okay.
So I'd be happy to take any questions. I do have a testifier.
Okay, and we're going to have your testifier come up now. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Gino Fragnito, and I'm the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society, and we'd like to thank Representative Rosenthal for bringing this legislation forward to address a number of tax administration items that CPAs believe will decrease compliance costs for both taxpayers and the state, while also providing some clear guidance to all taxpayers, not just those who are able to hire in-house tax staff. Taxpayers want to comply with the law, and a creation of a private letter ruling program would provide more clarity to comply in an increasingly complex tax world. The private letter ruling program would also provide clear guidance in gray areas or where the law may be silent or open to interpretation. We believe this program is less costly than litigation, and Minnesota taxpayers deserve firm guidance as they make decisions about business expansion and help Minnesota's economy prosper and grow. And it's my understanding that 48 other states have some form of a private letter ruling program, maybe not identical to what's being proposed here, but that 48 do. Minnesota and Alaska, I believe, are the only two that do not. So if it works well in other states, it can work well here, too. Serving a large set of customers is an important part of what the Department of Revenue does, but there's also a smaller set of their customer base that have more complex issues and may need additional guidance from time to time. This information could be available to all, but not needed by all. So if there was, through the process, a provision where the information is maybe redacted on identifying people and this information would become public, certainly that's something that the CPA profession could support. In closing, we think this legislation would provide more certainty to those individuals who need clarity and would not take away from other taxpayers' abilities to file a correct return. Simple returns simply do not require the resources to file and review or the amount of necessary time for a complex tax structure that may be required based on additional resources needed to review and ensure that the taxpayer is filing completely accurately. Everyone, no matter how simple or complex a situation, should be able to seek guidance from those who administer the tax laws. Sometimes complex questions come with an additional cost, and taxpayers are certainly willing to pay for those as long as they receive the guidance needed to comply correctly. People want to comply, and anything you can do to make that easier is certainly a benefit to all. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any questions for the testifier at this time? Thank you. We also have some folks from the Department of Revenue that wanted to come down and speak. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jenny Starr. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Business Tax at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And before we begin, I'll also introduce Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblock, the Assistant Commissioner over Individual Income Taxes. Before we begin, I just want to thank the author for meeting with us before today's hearing and for the offer to continue this conversation, to do what we can as this bill moves forward to make sure that it's administrable well for our customers. There are a number of concerns that the department has throughout the bill, and we'd like to walk you through those today. I'll start with Section 1 regarding private letter rulings. Just to put some of the comments into context, I want you to know that the department does provide reliable education and information through efficient and time-sensitive and effective tools to reach a broad audience of our customers. In the past year alone, we've helped 1.1 million customers in person, over the phone, and by answering questions over email. We've answered, of those contacts, 40,000 are email questions that come in to our sales and use tax, withholding, and income tax divisions. We support things like email subscription services. We offer education courses throughout the state and by webinar. And we maintain a robust website designed to answer questions. In fact, Avalara, a sales tax automation company that does business in all 50 states, recently named our website number one in the country because it is very easy to find the answers to questions people have. This bill would establish a private letter ruling program, which will require significant resources to support. And those resources would provide a program that serves only those who can afford it. The cost to the taxpayer is not only the statutory fee that would be paid to the state, but also the cost to hire an attorney or an accountant to prepare and draft the request and to respond to questions and information requests from the department. And as you heard, those private letter rulings have no precedential effect for anyone other than the person who paid for it. Certainly, others can read the private letter rulings in redacted form, but when you read them, they create a lot of questions about whether your fact situation is the same or different, and whether the law has changed since the time that private letter ruling was issued. And it just gives you a flavor for what a private letter ruling might sound like to you if you were reading it to try and decide if it applies to your own facts. Taxpayer was incorporated in year one and is a wholly owned subsidiary of parent one, a wholly owned subsidiary of parent two. In year two, taxpayer acquired 100% of the issued and outstanding equity interests in U.S. Sub 1, a state corporation. U.S. Sub 1 and its wholly owned subsidiaries, U.S. Sub 2, U.S. Sub 3, Foreign Sub 1, and Foreign Sub 2 provide services to clients. Parent 1, Parent 2, Taxpayer, U.S. Sub 1, U.S. Sub 2, and U.S. Sub 3 are all members of the Parent 2 consolidated group. And this is how the facts are recited for redacted purposes, making them quite difficult for the average taxpayer to decide if that private letter ruling is the same or different than their own facts. And even if they decide it is the same, it has no precedential effect. This bill is modeled after a federal program, and it is true that many states have some kind of a guidance program. Few states have something as robust as the federal program, and some states charge up to $10,000 to provide this kind of robust private ruling service. Others have less formal programs, and they limit the kinds of issues that they'll cover, and there's great variation in how many private rulings any particular state publishes each year. When we look at other states' programs, we see the greatest usage of those programs in what's called alternative apportionment requests in corporate franchise tax. And one thing I want you to know is that Minnesota law already provides for that program under Minnesota Statute Section 290.20. So it is already possible for our corporate taxpayers to request alternative apportionment rulings from the state of Minnesota, and we will provide those under Section 290.20. Another thing I think it's important for you to know is that Minnesota already has a public ruling program. We call these revenue notices, and they are provided under Minnesota law. Revenue notices, like private letter rulings, describe factual scenarios and explain how the department would apply Minnesota law to those factual scenarios. And anyone can rely on them. They are public and available for all. They are officially published in the state register, and we also post them on our website. And unlike private letter rulings, we keep them up to date. So we manage revenue notices. When there are law changes, we review them. We publish corrections and additions to those revenue notices as the law changes. And we also correct them when we hear from industry and learn that the factual scenarios as we understood them are different, and the revenue notice needs to be updated. Revenue notices came into law as a collaboration effort between the Department of Revenue and the Minnesota State Bar Association, and today that collaboration continues. This past December, we engaged attorneys, accountants, leadership from the Business Partnership and the Chamber to learn more about their needs and to identify ways to enhance communication and to answer the kinds of complex questions that people are looking for. And I hope you'll find in your folders today a handout that looks like this. This is the result of what we heard at that listening session, and you'll see at the front of it a letter from Commissioner Bowerly explaining the kinds of actions that we're already taking to be responsive to what we heard. And that includes things like we have dedicated ourselves to publishing more revenue notices this year than we did last year. We hear the need for enhanced efforts in publishing revenue notices that are important to folks. We've also dedicated ourselves to sharing drafts of those notices with stakeholders like industry members, the Bar Association, accountants, to make sure that we hear their feedback before those revenue notices are published. Just last week, we hosted a town hall with the Minnesota State Bar Association, and we invited members to bring their ideas to revenue. Revenue notices can be requested by anyone. The ideas for revenue notices that are needed come from all kinds of sources, and certainly our business tax professionals are the folks we want to hear from in understanding what topics we should cover. These kinds of enhancements to current law and to our current programs supports the department's vision that all of our customers, regardless of whether they have the opportunity and means to obtain personalized guidance, have access to broadly applicable information and education that helps our customers report, pay, and receive the right amount. No more, no less. And with that, I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Steenblatt to speak to Section 2.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Terry Steenblatt, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes.
Can you speak into the microphone? We just want to make sure that it's picked up for the record. Thank you.
I'm going to talk a little bit about Section 2 of the bill, and this section limits the authority to make sales, income, and corporate franchise tax assessments that are inconsistent with prior written positions taken by the department. And as drafted, this bill would have negative impacts on our customers because we would stop doing a number of things that we currently do that benefit our customers. So to start, as currently drafted, we believe Section 2 would prevent the department from adjusting any returns during return processing. So in today's world, what happens, returns come into the Department of Revenue, and if there was a simple calculation error and the department went to adjust that error, once we adjust that error, we issue a tax order, and that is a written notice. So, for example, a taxpayer might make a calculation error on their research and development credit, and we may fix that error. We automatically adjust returns such as we do, like federal conformity. In 2013, we quickly adjusted 210,000 returns affected by late federal conformity so that taxpayers could quickly receive $11.5 million in additional tax benefits that they were entitled to. In the case of mortgage indebtedness that occurred this year as a result of the most recent federal update, we quickly automatically made adjustments for $2.5 million. And this bill would prevent us from doing that type of work. Again, because when we make those adjustments, we're simply quickly making an adjustment to that return for either calculation error or the example of federal conformity that I mentioned. We're not taking an in-depth, holistic look at that return because we know we'll have that opportunity to do that down the road. However, when we do make these adjustments in processing, we are issuing a tax order. And the order identifies in writing the items that have been adjusted. Later, the department might identify that return for review, and we might find that the taxpayer, for example, does not meet the necessary criteria for the entire research and development credit that's taken. Current law allows us to audit that return and make the necessary adjustments at that time. Under this bill, as it's drafted now, we could not make the adjustment during return processing. Instead, any item identified as needing adjustment during return processing would need to be fully reviewed at the time to ensure we are not missing an issue that may come up later. This will significantly delay the ability of the department to make appropriate adjustments to returns during the processing period and to implement bills like retroactive federal conformity. In addition, the agency's efficiency will be significantly reduced because we will no longer be able to rely on technology to make quick and simple adjustments. And again, this will affect all taxpayers that are filing a return with the department. We also believe that Section 2 of this bill will chill the department's efforts to answer questions over email. Today, we focused on providing reliable information in the least expensive manner and with the quickest turnaround time possible. For example, we responded to over 40,282 emails in our sales and use tax, withholding tax, and income tax division alone. Our current turnaround time for those emails is 2 to 3 business days. If we continued answering questions over email as we do now, this bill were law, we would not be able to provide this information because we would need to make sure we have all the facts and supporting information from the taxpayer before providing an answer that would bind the department going forward. We anticipate there could be litigation with customers over whether facts were fully disclosed in the email exchange. Finally, this bill as currently drafted would significantly increase the length of audits, the number of auditors assigned to each audit, the number of auditors at one place of business during an audit, and the amount of time that is spent at that particular business. I'm now going to transition it back to Assistant Commissioner Starr, who will talk a little bit about the audit process.
So in audit, the place of our most significant concern is in sales and use tax. And the reason that is because sales and use tax generally has one line on the return for the general sales tax rate. The scope of any particular audit includes all taxable transactions within the audit period, but the number of those transactions could be in the hundreds of thousands depending on the type of business you're operating. We use something called sampling to choose a sample of transactions to look at during the audit. And this saves taxpayers and the Department of Revenue a significant amount of time and resources. But under this bill, as drafted today, we believe that we could no longer use those kinds of sampling techniques. And I'll give you just an example to try and illustrate this point. If you consider a retailer that sells food, electronics, clothing, cards and gifts, appliances and furniture, they're going to have thousands of products for sale. The store uses something called the tax matrix, which is a list of sales transactions along with product codes. Those product codes are matched with our sales tax laws, so some products are coded as taxable and some codes are coded as exempt. During the audit period, the retailer mistakenly codes honey roasted nuts as food and sells them as exempt. And at the time when we go through the audit and sample a number of transactions, we never come across the product code for honey roasted nuts. We close out the audit, and that's not an issue we necessarily found But certainly the audit order addresses other items of food that are or other items that aren't taxable. Later, we come back, years later, 5 years pass, the retailer regularly updates its product matrix. Maybe they even review fact sheet 102B on candy, but they don't change the product code for honey roasted nuts. We return for another audit, and this time in sampling, we find that particular error. And all of this time, the retailer has had a competitive advantage. I realize we're talking about nuts. It's just an example. It's a competitive advantage over other retailers who have been collecting tax on honey roasted nuts. Because if you've ever looked at the rules about candy and food, you'd know that honey roasted nuts actually are candy, and they're taxable under Minnesota law. This bill would mean that that first audit is binding and that this taxpayer would be treated differently than its competitors. In addition, it seems we think that this provision gives the department an authority that was not contemplated under our laws. As the Supreme Court announced in Wallace in 1971, the Department of Revenue under the Minnesota Constitution does not have the authority to determine what the laws should be. And we're still reviewing those constitutional challenges, and we just wanted to flag that for you today. With all that said, I do want you to know that we hear what people are saying, and we are actively engaged in conversations with our customers. We know that our customers from time to time have had an experience where they feel strongly that the department provided guidance in audit and then later somehow changed its position to their detriment. And that's why it's really important we feel that we continue to keep a supervisor's name and telephone number on the letters that begin an initial audit. It's really important to us that taxpayers and our customers reach out to us as early as possible when they have a concern about an audit and give us as much opportunity as we can to support our customers in finding a resolution. Our current programs are designed to decrease burdens and increase services by answering questions over email, making adjustments while processing returns, using techniques like sampling to decrease burdens during audit, and we are very concerned that this bill would accomplish the opposite, increasing timelines, limiting the opportunities to ask questions in informal ways, and increasing the burden of audits. Now I'll turn it back to Assistant Commissioner Steenbach on Sections 3 and 4.
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to talk briefly about Section 3 and 4, and then we'll close out our portion of the testimony. I want to talk a few minutes, spend a few minutes talking about the penalties and the under Section 3 and 4. These sections raise concerns for the department because they would create inconsistency and ambiguity in administration of our laws. Second, Section 3 would give the commissioner complete discretion to impose, not impose, or abate civil tax penalties. This would be difficult to implement on a fair or consistent basis, and it would likely generate substantial litigation. This would give a sweeping level of discretion to the department regarding penalty imposition with no applicable standards in place. Currently, there are standards that are in place that allows taxpayers to know that they are being treated fairly. This section could create the false impression that the well-connected can get their penalties abated, eroding public confidence in a fair administration of our tax laws. Regarding Section 4, penalties are used as a way to ensure that taxpayers are not intentionally ignoring due dates. It ensures that taxpayers are treated fairly. Current law requires the commissioner to impose a penalty of a certain percentage when a taxpayer fails to pay their tax liability on time. No matter how small the penalty may be, when the applicable penalty percentage is applied to the unpaid amount. Current law is fair. It treats those who file and pay on time differently than those who file and pay late. This bill creates inequity by completely eliminating penalties of less than $150. It unfairly treats those who file and pay late the same as those who file and pay on time. This bill also creates some ambiguity. Some late payment penalties are imposed on a graduated scale. So in today's world, we may apply a penalty, and that penalty may continue to increase depending upon the situation that is at play. So based on the legislation that we have in place today, or the bill that's in front of us today, it's unclear as to whether just the first 150 would not be imposed, and then what happens when the penalty starts out under 150, but over the course of time it exceeds 150, how would we handle that particular situation? And finally, I'm going to talk briefly about costs before closing. While the bill does provide the commissioner with the authority to charge a fee, the fee structure established does not reflect actual costs and requires the commissioner to refund the money if it takes longer than 90 days to issue the ruling. As you know, it often takes time for taxpayers to provide the information, and once we receive it, it takes time to review to provide an accurate response to the taxpayer. The bill does not address any days that the taxpayer representative might take in responding to requests for additional information or to answer additional questions we may have on the private letter ruling. The fee structure outlined does not promote effective rulemaking, and the restrictions on charging does not reflect actual costs. So in conclusion, if implemented, there would be a number of negative impacts. There would be specialized guidance only for those who can afford it. There would be reduction in informal education and information services that we currently provide to taxpayers. It would increase the burden during audits, both for the department and for the taxpayer, and it creates inconsistencies, inequities, and potential litigation risk. And with that, we'll stand for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, any questions at all? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Rosenthal, for bringing the bill forward. I do think there are some complex and unique situations where this kind of approach, private letter rulings, makes sense. And as much as there's a number of other states, although they do it in different ways, are getting accomplished, it seems pretty reasonable to expect that something like that can be accomplished. And I hear you're willing to continue working with the department on that. So I just hope as you continue your journey, you get there, because I think the general goal is a good one, and I appreciate you working on it.
Representative Rosenthal.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you. I am open to working with the department. When Representative Thiessen and I brought this bill forward in 2015, I believe, they really did go out of their way and have listening sessions across the state and have done some good work. This bill is in the form it is now, so we can talk and come up with a solution that helps everybody. I certainly don't want to put anybody in a better tax position than anyone else. But as you said, Representative Johnson, this is a very complicated world, and there are instances where these private letter rulings will be of great effect. And again, it's done on the federal level, and it's done in 48 states in different ways, and we're willing to talk about different ways to move this bill forward if we have the chance.
For the assistant commissioners, I noticed that you were reading from your you have written testimony. If you could provide copies of that for both of you to the committee, we'd appreciate that. And then I've got Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not sure if it's to Representative Rosenthal or the testifiers, but, you know, I look at this as a way to hopefully prevent some protracted court cases. There's a lot of small businesses I've dealt with. In fact, our little small business, where over the years you get into issues that you're really not sure of, and this would give, to me, an alternative way of finding out whether or not it's okay to proceed that way, rather than filing the return, then waiting to see if you get audited, and maybe waiting for years to find out the ultimate decision. So I guess to the testifiers, I realize that there would be some additional work or maybe startup efforts, but don't you think for the benefit of the taxpayer this would be helpful, just to avoid litigation and the potential of litigation if they're trying to do the right thing but can't figure it out?
Assistant Commissioner Starr.
Madam Chair, Representative, We absolutely agree with you that there is an important place for public rulings that help answer complex questions. And we are dedicated to working with our business tax professionals to find ways to enhance our existing revenue notice program to provide that kind of information on complex questions. Our hope is that we could do it in a way that we could publish answers to even complicated questions in a broadly applicable way that is helpful to a wide variety of readers, and that we can, through our normal process, keep those public rulings up to date as the laws change, so that there aren't any traps for people who might be reading a private letter ruling and are unaware of the ways in which the law, either through the legislative process or through court opinions, has come to change.
Well, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, but there's a difference between advice and assurance. And my sense is that anybody that would be going as far as a private letter ruling would probably have an accountant involved and therefore wouldn't do this haphazardly. But, you know, especially for small businesses, these issues are huge, because if you do it the wrong way and can't have some assurance that you're not going to be audited or have it disallowed, you could put a person out of business, whereas this way at least there'd be some there would be assurance up front. And I recognize that it puts an additional burden on revenue, but I think we also have to think about the clientele that's actually paying the tax. So I'm wondering if it's just an impediment to doing it, because I would the other side of it would say that the business itself would be willing to would have to be willing to accept the parameters in which the ruling was issued.
Starr, did you want to comment? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative, maybe just some points of information just to round out the conversation, right? One thing to keep in mind is, like I mentioned earlier, one of the ways in which these programs are utilized the most in other states is for alternative apportionment requests, and that program already exists here in Minnesota. Another thing to keep in mind is that the most complicated questions that we have around income taxes in particular really are in the federal code, right? So they're pre-federal taxable income. And to the extent the complications of the questions exist, the federal program already exists to help answer those kinds of questions. And then just to keep in mind, right, 30% of state revenues here in Minnesota generally comes from individual income tax, and only about 3% comes from corporate income tax. So when we're sort of comparing a really robust private letter ruling program as is contemplated in this bill as something comparable to a federal program, I just want to suggest that this is a really robust program that will largely be used, I think, in the corporate franchise tax arena, which is a much smaller proportion of our revenue stream than when you're comparing this program to something that exists in the federal laws. And I just mean these not in a debate with the assertions that you're making, but just in a way in which to put these in context. But again, we're really looking for ways that make sense for as many customers as we can here in Minnesota. And we'd like time to continue to use our revenue notice program and see if we can't meet people's needs in answering these complex questions through the tools that already exist in Minnesota law.
Representative Oak.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I have no further questions. Thank you, Commissioners. Appreciate you coming by. Representative, I do have one more testifier. And then go ahead, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And to the assistant commissioners, are these revenue notes, as in a private letter ruling, you can change these revenue notes. They're not binding, in my understanding.
Ms. Starr?
Madam Chair, Representative, revenue notices are binding, interestingly enough, on the Department of Revenue. So they are actually a pretty interesting creation of law, meaning we can publish a revenue notice, and the Department of Revenue is absolutely bound by that notice unless revoked or modified. you, if you disagree with the notice, you're not required to file your return in accordance to the notice, right? You can file your return and assert that you believe the law is different and that the Department of Revenue is wrong. But to the extent you rely on the revenue notice, the Department of Revenue is bound and cannot assess additional tax for your reliance on that notice. So in that way, they are absolutely binding, and not only on the person that requested it, but on everyone who relies.
Representative Rosenthal? Okay. All right. Thank you, Commissioners. And I have one more testifier. I've got Mr. Haveman. And anybody else that wishes to testify, if you want to wave your hand. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. We are a research and education organization in support of sound tax policy and fiscally responsible government. Tax administration may not be the most interesting or dynamic policy topic, but good tax policy rooted in a system of voluntary compliance requires tax administration that is effective, efficient, fair, and responsive to the needs of taxpayers. So we appreciate the opportunity today to offer some information and perspective on this bill and the importance of the issues it seeks to address. I am not a tax practitioner. I want to make that very clear. However, our organization's membership does include a lot of tax attorneys and tax accountants. And last year, in response to some concerns that were being raised by our members, we conducted a survey of tax practitioners on the state of state tax administration. The results of that are actually, I believe, included in your materials, our report. Unsurprisingly, our findings included in the report that we released last December identified some things the state can be very proud of and at the same time some opportunities for improvement. Clearly, the strongest praise regarding Minnesota's state tax administration could be described as the first line of communication with taxpayers on compliance matters. You've already heard a brief description of the long list of activities that the department has been involved in with respect to taxpayer education, resources, training, services, compliance, training programs, all of which have been very well received by the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota, and do a very good job of ably serving the routine and common compliance matters that a significant number of our taxpayers face. That said, respondents also identified two primary areas of concern. First was a tax compliance environment featuring too much ambiguity, uncertainty, and in some situations, inconsistency regarding more complex interpretive situations that makes voluntary compliance difficult. Fact sheets and general resources are a fantastic tool for taxpayers, but they do have limitations, especially in the highly complex areas of income taxation and sales and use taxation. Survey respondents expressed a strong interest in reducing interpretive ambiguity and having greater predictability in the form of actionable verbal or written guidance on these more complex interpretive matters. A second area of potential improvement revolved around what would be called fair treatment concerns. And these are case-specific circumstances across the spectrum of compliance activities in which respondents felt norms of fair and just treatment had been violated and where greater procedural protections for taxpayers were needed. In our report, we concluded that the state provides a good foundation for compliance in routine and commonplace tax situations and the circumstances affecting the majority of Minnesota taxpayers. However, we also conclude an opportunity for improvement does exist in processes pertaining to the more sophisticated and complex areas of tax law. And that means improving interpretive consistency and providing more reliable and actionable guidance on these matters, which are both essential to voluntary compliance as well as business planning. Likewise, some procedural protections could be strengthened. This bill addresses some of the more notable issues which were flagged by the practitioners. Since our report, as you've heard, the department has reached out to the tax community in listening sessions to better understand and address these concerns. The department should absolutely be recognized and commended for this outreach and, again, for the extraordinary efforts that they have made with their award-winning clear language efforts and all the other resources and resource investments that they've made in tax compliance over the recent years. In our survey, There was strong agreement with the idea that better communication with the department is an absolute cornerstone for improvement. That said, there will be differences of opinion on whether better communication alone is sufficient to address these needs or whether statutory remedies are required. We conclude better engagement and lines of communication does not preclude the need for some statutory action. At the same time, we also conclude that statutory remedies can and absolutely should be strengthened by the direct involvement and perspective of the department. For many years, the revenue department has been tasked with doing more with less. Understandably, this has triggered concerns that new initiatives will take resources away from voluntary compliance activities serving all taxpayers. Even though tax administration must be responsive to the needs of all taxpayers, greater responsiveness to compliance matters that our multi-state and multinational businesses in this state inevitably find themselves in because of their more complex tax situations is an important and wise investment. That's true not just because of their relative share of business tax revenues that they provide the state, but also because of their role in Minnesota's economy overall. We would argue it's not favoritism, it's just very smart tax administration. Finally, let me suggest the benefits of attending to these issues extend beyond a better system of voluntary compliance. It also provides secondary benefits with respect to public attitudes and trust in government. It is likely that a lot of public resentment and frustration with government is often fueled by how taxpayers are treated in those relatively rare moments when they must deal with government and its processes on a very personal level. In this respect, process and procedural protections is no different from the many other investments the state is making and plans to make in order to improve customer service and responsiveness to taxpayers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Haveman, would you consider the revenue note as a sufficient replacement for the private letter ruling?
Madam Chair, I think that is a question best left to the actual tax practitioners. I can only report on what our survey concluded with respect to that issue. And that is, while revenue notices are appreciated, they also, many of the practitioners consistently found it did not provide an adequate level of clarity and certainty and predictability in order to do their tax planning and conduct their business activities. An example that was routinely cited was the revenue notice regarding residential determination, which was published, I believe, last year. Many of the respondents identified that as a classic example where the revenue notice still didn't deliver on what needed to be delivered with respect to necessary clarity and determination on these matters.
Okay. Members, any questions for Mr. Haveman? All right. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to ask Mr. Fragnito if you can come back to the table, please. Welcome to the committee. I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Haveman. Would you consider the revenue notice as a sufficient replacement for a private letter ruling?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Gino Fragnito of the Minnesota CPA Society. And I believe the revenue notices are a good supplement to a private letter ruling program. However, I don't believe that for the types of situations that a private letter ruling program would address, that the revenue note goes into that detail and provides the same level of certainty for a company or a taxpayer who's looking for that certainty.
Okay. And I don't know if this is a question for you or for Representative Rosenthal. You know, one of the questions was having equal access to this information. Can you tell me typically who's going to be requesting a private letter ruling? And maybe Mr. Fragnito, if you want to start, and then Representative Rosenthal, you want to finish? Okay.
Go ahead. Well, Madam Chair, it would be across the board. I mean, it would certainly depend on your individual tax situation and what the position was that you were looking to seek some clarity and guidance in order to make a determination when you're doing planning or looking to proceed with funding or other places where a business might need some certainty to be able to make those future decisions.
Okay, and Representative Rosenthal, anything to add? Or
Madam Chair, members, thank you. This bill is meant to help in situation that are really, really complex, and just simple emails or listings on the department's site are insufficient. And these companies want to do the right thing, and these private letter rulings will allow them to do the right thing. I believe we introduced this bill in this form because it mirrors federal legislation. But again, as I said, I'm willing to work with the department. There are 48 states who do this in differing ways, and I'm sure we can come up with a solution that will help Minnesota's businesses and taxpayers.
Well, thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Thank you, Mr. Fragnito. I kind of consider this kind of the same way that we treat campaign finance board. We know we can go to the campaign finance board with confidence and confidentially and ask for an opinion on different laws to make sure that we're interpreting it the correct way. And this is kind of the same deal, only it's extended towards tax policy. So I do appreciate you bringing this forward. And with that, you've got the last word. Any other closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And this bill is a work in progress, and I really applaud the Department of Revenue for listening to us when we first brought this bill forward. They've done a lot of great work, and there's still a little bit of a ways to go, and I think this bill in its current form can change, and I'm willing to work with the department if we are allowed to move on, and I plan to, and this is just common sense. It's done in 48 other states in one form or another. I think we can come up with a version that really, really fits Minnesota and helped all our taxpayers.
Great. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 918 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And members, in your packet, you've got the minutes from February 23rd. Representative Lilly, you want to move the minutes for February 23rd?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly moves the minutes for February 23rd. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. Members, also in your packet is House File 1773. This is my bill. It is not officially before the committee, so there will not be a motion on this at all. It's just for informational purposes. Basically, this is in tandem with Representative Rosenthal's bill. It has some notification timelines on here to clarify when you have to give notice for appeals and the like, and then also notices through postmarks through the U.S. mail and so forth. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. I can have Mr. Gearing walk through it if that's helpful to members. Otherwise, I stand for any questions on this bill. All right. Is there anybody that wishes to testify to House File 1773? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joanne Turner. I'm the Chief Judge of the Tax Court, Minnesota Tax Court. Two of the provisions in House File 1773 are carryover provisions. They were not enacted. They were part of the last year's omnibus tax bill, and they are back here in roughly equivalent form. I'd like to thank Representative Anderson for including them in this bill. And I'm here to answer any questions you might have on an informational basis. I would note there is one difference between a provision that was included in last year's omnibus bill and the same provision in this bill, and that has to do with the deadline on post-trial motions. The provision that was included in last year's bill would have conformed deadlines for post-trial motions to the same deadlines in the rules of civil procedure to which my court is also subject. This version of that would still have one discrepancy between those two deadlines, and I would just point that out. Under the civil procedure rules to which my court is subject, post-trial motions have to be made within 30 days. This is an historical anachronism. when the tax court was first formed in the reformed in the 1970s in Chapter 271, our governing statute was enacted. The deadlines were the same in our court as they were in district court. Over time, district court changed their deadline for post-trial motions from 15 to 30 days. Ours just never got changed. At the same time that the district court changed that 15 to 30 days, they changed the 30 days to 60 days. So the motion in district court has to be filed within 30 days, heard within 60. The provision here obviously would allow us 30 days for the motion to be filed, but then would require it to be heard within another 30 days. Otherwise, the other provision that's here conforms the jurisdictional limit for our small claims division to the same jurisdictional limit that's used for conciliation court in district court. Those provisions, those dollar limits, were the same until 1987. In 1987, they began to increase at the district court level, and ours just never got changed. And I have come to understand why. But so for 40 years, our jurisdictional limit in small claims has not increased for 40 years, not since 30 years, I'm sorry, not since 1987. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Members, any questions? Thank you, Ms. Turner. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify to this bill? Okay. Thank you. That's it. As I mentioned, this is an informational hearing on House File 1773. With that, members, we are adjourned.